reference input of the backup service monitor because a buddy of mine works for a local cell carrier and had him meet me up one of the local cell sites in the area. I brought the thing in there and hooked the piece of coax cable up to a spare rack he had, which was running a GPS discipline oscillator, and I was using that as a timing reference in the back of my service monitor. So that means I was coming out my internal oscillator using an external, extremely accurate oscillator, much more accurate than my internal oscillator. And I did the same measurement off the air at this cell site as I could receive different carriers with a magnet antenna, VHF magnet antenna, or UHF magnet antenna out the door to measure these UHF TV carriers. And very quickly, what I'll say with that is, and I have something else about that later on after that, is these carriers, most of them seem to be very, very close, within a tenth or two, one or two tenths of a frequency off each other that I can determine, but some are specifically off, noticeably off from that frequency. And they did come out to the frequency, Eric. I think it said 309.441 and change. As far as with the accuracy of the service monitor, it can only measure down to 1 hertz accuracy. Just on a normal display, I could determine a little more than that. I made the same kind of measurement at a place I worked a short time ago, and they had an internal clocking system that was a rubidium standard in the back, GPS disciplined rubidium standard to the different benches. So you had the availability of putting a 10 meg input to your service monitor and did the same kind of measurement again. If these TV carriers off the air were either coming from Empire or four times square, whatever these are, the transmitter, what I could see off the air, again, I got most of them being very, very close to each other, within 0.1, 0.2, 0.3 hertz, or within they see the same thing on that particular service monitor. I don't mean Motorola, not mine. But some of them were a little off, like about 5, 10 hertz off frequency. But most of them, I measure, would be on frequency. So that really gets to the heart of my question here, who's right and who's wrong?
As I pass it over to Eric, who is our local broadcast engineer, Channel 13 and Channel 21 in New York City, if you happen to know, Eric, what is the frequency accuracy that the Federal Communications Commission requests of that pilot tone of a digital television over-the-air broadcast? What is their requested accuracy? Is there a penalty if you don't meet that accuracy? And how reliable do you believe that is? I'm almost positive the answer that Joe really needs is that he needs a global positioning satellite, disciplined, local rubidium or cesium oscillator. It's the only thing that's going to really give him complete satisfaction. And once he gets that, and he measures over-the-air pilot tones, over-the-air digital television broadcast pilot tones, what kind of inaccuracy do you guess he might experience? Because I'll bet you you've made measurements like this yourself, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2LIW, K2EJ. I wanted to point out something. Channel 21 is driven by a GPS trained oscillator, disciplined as you call it. Where in Channel 13, unfortunately, we haven't been able to mount a GPS antenna that gives us good results at the 78th floor of Empire, simply because we're not on the setback, and you know, they charge you for every antenna and so on and so forth. So you'll see a difference between Channel 13 and Channel 21. The accuracy, from what I remember, I got to look it up again. I'm pretty sure, as far as the pilot goes, it's plus or minus 3 hertz, and the pilot should actually be somewhere in that neighborhood. As far as stability goes, they give you a jitter value that they're interested in. Not so much how much you can drift, so to speak, because there are a lot of transmitters out there that are not GPS disciplined, and there's a little bit of difference between them sometimes, depending upon how good the oscillator is and the exciter, and that depends upon the company that manufactures it. Everybody's a little bit different, so you're going to see some differences between the various different on-the-air sources. You know, if you're looking for 10 to the minus 24, you ain't going to find it on a lot of them. I'm 10 to the minus 14, I'm sorry, the minus 12 even. So over a long period of time, you'll see it move a whole bunch. And the whole bunch we're talking about is, you know, fractions of hertz. K2RW, K2 again.
If I was running a low-power digital television local station, like I think Channel 43 is, and I was not meeting the requirement of 3 hertz of accuracy of that pilot tone, and I was 30 hertz wrong, I don't think anybody would care. But if I'm a major broadcast system from Empire State Building in New York City, where I'm covering a tri-state area, and if the FCC spec happens to be 3 hertz, and my inaccuracy was 30 hertz, what would be the impact of that, Eric? I'm having trouble believing that anybody would have trouble watching that channel. I think the average television watcher would never know the difference. And does the FCC have a fine? They would probably give you notice that, hey, you've got an error and you better correct it. But what would be the real impact if I had 30 hertz or 300 hertz of inaccuracy of that pilot tone of a major broadcast center? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, there's a couple of different kinds of broadcast stations. There's a full-power broadcast station, something called a Class A broadcast station, and there's a low-power TV broadcast station. We're talking about TV. The rules are basically the same between them, but the low-power stations get a little more forgiveness. But as far as the FCC is concerned, they're more concerned about things like jitter rather than frequency accuracy. And if you go back to the day when we were transmitting both analog and digital, there was a deliberate offset between the analog transmitter and the digital transmitter. It gives it a little, slightly a little bit more guideband, even though, you know, you're running adjacent channel to an analog signal, one would bang into each other, so. And the FCC really doesn't give a hoot these days unless you're interfering. You're that far off frequency that you're bothering your neighbor. That's the only time that they'll get involved. But the receivers have a pretty wide, AFC in it that allows the receiver to pick it up even if it's, say, a half a megahertz off frequency or a quarter of a megahertz off frequency. There's plenty of tolerance there. K2RW, K2J.
Right now, digital television has an assigned channel that's exactly 6.000 megahertz wide. And as you broadcast a digital television signal, it is my belief from my previous conversations with you, Eric, that that signal must flow through an extremely sharp, skirted filter so that the amount of energy you put into the adjacent channel is a large number of decibels suppressed. So therefore, a frequency inaccuracy of 30 hertz, 300 hertz, 3 kilohertz on the pilot tone of a digital broadcast signal, I don't think it would violate that amount of adjacent channel interference. Therefore, why does the FCC have a spec as tight as 3 hertz if even with 300 hertz of error, there would be no real grief that the average television receiver demodulator, digital demodulator with its automatic frequency control capability would never know the difference. So I'm wondering why that spec is so tight to begin with. Is it because people like Joe are going to be using that pilot tone as a frequency reference? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. It's really all about the position of the symbols. And it's really all about timing, not really frequency, so. Where that pilot is, okay, helps in demodulation. It actually helps to train the IMQ demodulator how to separate that signal. I mean, it's more complicated than that. But really, we're talking more about timing. And believe it or not, a lot of devices will take the one pulse per second and use that to the edges of that as its reference point. But the reality is that the place where the pilot is really a reference to, too, you know, it's the start of the reference to demodulating the signal. It's not actually where the sync word comes from, but it's enough to get the oscillator and the receiver in the right place. Yeah, and as far as adjacent channels go, let me read it draft. The rules say that you need your edges, your channel edges need to be 60 dB down, or the minimum actually at the band edge, you have to be, 47 or 48 dB down on the skirt of the edges of your transmission. But ultimately you're looking to be in the 50 to 60 is where you want the shoulders of your signal to be. And that's what keeps the two adjacent stations from overlapping into each other. And the mass filters are really very sharp. Well, you've seen my mass filters, like a huge oil drum. K2RIWK, 2JET.
There's lots of ways of solving this problem. It sounds to me like the ultimate local reference for John's laboratory and Joe's laboratory would be a frequency-disciplined oscillator listening to a global positioning satellite receiver. That, in turn, is keeping the accuracy of a rubidium or cesium standard. And we're talking about some fairly expensive, usually fairly large, power-consuming, rack-mounted piece of equipment. A fairly similar frequency accuracy problem existed 10 or so years ago at the Qualcomm company. Qualcomm was manufacturing this thing called Omnitrax, where a large number of tractor trailers traveling around the United States had a receiver mounted above the cab that had an antenna that aimed straight up in the air, so to speak, listening at 15 gigahertz to a satellite signal, and on that satellite at 15 gigahertz was the local communication from your dispatching center telling you that, yeah, you're driving through North Dakota right now. Let me drop. And there were no local cell sites there, so the only communication we've got with you is through the satellite. You're going to be going through South Dakota next. We want you to stop at the so-and-so factory and pick up this load that we didn't know about when you left our dispatching center. And on the way there, you're going to be going down Highway 615, which we know has got an accident and a delay. So take the so-and-so bypass. So that kind of communication, bi-directional communication, from the cab of the tractor trailer trucks to the satellite, to their dispatching center, anywhere in the United States. That was an extremely popular system. Qualcomm had, in my opinion, a license to print money as they were building these things. They built hundreds of thousands of these things at quite a few $1,000s per installation. Their requirement is to have a compact local oscillator, very accurate. And the way they solved the problem is they made a 10 megacycle high quality crystal oscillator that had built into it a integrated circuit chip that had been programmed with what is the drift rate of that particular oscillator. In other words, each oscillator they built, they measured its drift rate, they measured its temperature variation. In other words, did it go up a hertz when you go 10 degrees centigrade higher in frequency? All of that was programmed into the integrated circuit chip into each one of these oscillators. Therefore, that oscillator didn't require anything more than 1 minute of warm-up time, so to speak, and it gave you the kind of frequency accuracy you get with an ovenized crystal, but it wasn't ovenized. That whole oscillator assembly was a couple of cubic inches, and by those techniques, Qualcomm was able to achieve extremely good accuracy. And some of the smart ham radio operators are managing to get their hands on those oscillators. I've got one of those, and one of these days I'm going to run a frequency accuracy test on it to see if it's meeting spec, or did I get one that's out of spec, if you know what I mean.
Repeater, timeout.
So you can tell there are other solutions to this particular problem. By the way, as I listen to my signal coming out of the Eastern Link, Eric, I hear no audio above 1 kilohertz, and I'm hearing the usual digital noise. So that particular link is quite muffled, and probably you know about that. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Yeah, I do. It's going to change sometime this week. I'm preparing this stuff to replace it with. Sorry, I know about that. It's also, the levels are being overdriven a little bit, so. I'll get to it.
As you guys can tell, Eric is maintaining a hell of a lot of electronics in his life. He's helping people with their problems in New Jersey. He's doing some of the work at Channel 13 at Empire State Building in New York City and another location in New York City. And in Syosset, there's another Channel 13. And he's maintaining at least two repeaters and all of the linking with reference to this particular club. Eric, it sounds to me like you need a staff of two or three people aiding you in this operation. Have you ever made a request that you could use a little bit of help? I think you do, Eric. I think you're spread a little bit thin. KE2EJ for any comment. KQRIW in the TechNet.
All right, KQRIW, KE2EJ. Well, the economic downturn that we had kind of put an end to. People helping. Well, actually, my latest project, which is good, is I'm an FM station in New Jersey. We have a site at Four Times Square, and basically, what I'm going to do is fill in Manhattan using synchronous in phase. FM exciter that it's going to run about 10 watts. I've got to make the audio delay so that the same. I got to pick a point somewhere in Manhattan that I say is a listening point and phase the damn things in together. That's going to be a real neat trick. K2RIWK2J.
Yeah, you thought I was asking for help that you need for your business, for your day job, for your hobby of the electronics you're maintaining for ham radio purposes. I think you need a little more of a staff there, too. As you can tell, there is no exact answer to what you're seeking, Joe. As you pursue these various techniques, you're going to get higher and higher accuracy. You're an exacting kind of an engineering guy. You'll never be thoroughly happy, but it's going to get better. You'll be developing techniques. You'll be telling us about those techniques as you develop them. And there's a whole art and science to spectral purity of oscillators, accuracy of oscillators, traceability of oscillators, the standards around the world and how well they compare with each other, global positioning satellites, geosynchronous satellites, broadcast centers. We all need accurate frequency, and cell sites, for the timing reason, cell sites need ridiculous accuracy of their oscillators. And can you imagine the kind of problems they run into when you get a superstorm Sandy and a power outage, and therefore all their electronics gets turned off, cooled off, and whatever, and has to all be restarted, resynchronized, and so on. Quite a business. Back to you, Joe, for any final comments. I know you didn't get an exact answer, but at least it's an interesting discussion. Great question. Debate2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Debate2RYY. Well, you know, this started years ago when I first got my hands onto a service monitor because, you know, I realized the accuracy of the service monitor is only good as the internal oscillator within. When the cellular carriers on 800 meg used to run amps, talking about AT&T and Verizon, and I worked for one of them many, many years ago, when they ran amps system, which is analog, the setup channels were measurable on the air. And I knew for a fact that the Verizon using a GPS distal oscillator running their Series 2 equipment, which is still analog at the time. And I asked about the accuracy of that, and I was told the accuracy was better. What you can measure up to be way better than 1 hertz accuracy at a gig. So I says, well, that's good enough to me. Paying my service monitor only went up that high. And I could look at the different carriers of the cell sites off the air at my house with an Omni antenna, and every single carrier I looked at was the same exact frequency. So I determined, well, if they're all the same, they're probably all correct. Now, it's a very good way of me zeroing in my service monitor to make sure it was also measuring something correct. Now, with the stuff being digital, I can't do that anymore. I can't demodulate the digital information coming out of a cell site. I have no carrier to look at anymore. This is why I've turned to looking at other avenues, namely measuring broadcast carrier accuracy. And this, again, it goes back to this basic question. Some are one way, some are another way. Who's right, who's wrong?
And black and white question. It's sort of like asking of all the people on my block, which one of them are honest and which ones are not so honest. And these are relative words. Nobody is perfectly honest, nobody is perfectly moral, and nobody is ever perfect in accuracy. It's a relative world, but some of those things can be measured. I'm going to skip over Vito temporarily and go directly to John, number two, KC2SHO, just in case he's somebody who has to leave us in a while. I'm pretty sure that Vito can hang in there for a while. And as I look at Mount Laurel, where you live, John, KC2SHO, you are 100 miles from us. You're really down the road a piece, so I'm reasonably sure you're talking to us by Echolink or some other technique. To do that RF-wise would require some pretty serious equipment. Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Hotel Oscar, K2RIW, the TechNet. Sorry I kept you waiting so long, John.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. No worries at all. I don't have anywhere to go. I like to tune into this TechNet and listen for the whole duration. I really appreciate everything you guys do here. It's been quite educational and entertaining and, well, everything else in between. The discussions here are very good. Again, I really enjoy it. I'm coming to you via IRLP. I have my own IRLP node here I've constructed, and that's the method we're using to reach you guys. I don't have anywhere to go, so if you prefer to hand it to the other one first, that's fine. Otherwise, I'll continue. Go ahead.
While we've got you hooked up right now, please continue, John. KC2SHO on IRLP, K2RIW and TechNet. By the way, in the case of IRLP, I wonder, is there a computer program that you're using where you get on the screen a display of who else is signed up to IRLP and listening by that mode? Can you find out how many other people are there? And when I pass it over to John later on, I'm going to ask him how many people he sees on the screen that are listening to us by way of Echolink. KC2SHO, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
You can't use IRLP from a computer. That's not allowed.
Shows you what I know. You got it, John.
Dick, I have a direct comment to your question, which I can answer. The other guy can't.
Okay, yeah. Let's let John talk first, and then I'll pick you up, Joe. KC2SHO, you've got the floor.
Four nodes connected at the moment, so on that that channel of that reflector, there are four connected. Typically, there's more, but earlier today, I believe there was a problem, and somebody either restarted the reflector or something like that, because I had lost connectivity, I wasn't able to connect, then I noticed there was one connected, and I became number two at that moment, so I'm assuming there was some type of reboot or reset or somebody booted everybody off. I'm not really sure, but go ahead.
Okay, that's some of the information, but you had a question, John, so please proceed with your question.
Okay, let's see, I'm going to do my best to format this question, hopefully you'll understand it. With my limited RF knowledge compared to the average of the group, I know enough to be, well, slightly more than dangerous, but we've been doing this for 15 years, so there's a lot of experience behind it. So my question is, when we take measurements on something like an S-parameter test set or a network analyzer or a vector network analyzer, whenever we have a significantly low enough return loss, there is always a series of, you know, upside-down curves that appear on the screen. What is the reason for this phenomenon? Is this a limitation or a thing derived within the test equipment itself, a limitation, say, or is this a natural RF phenomenon? Go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions to make sure. There's three different questions you could be asking. And in the case of using a vector network analyzer to measure so-called S-parameters, scattering parameters, some people do it with a polar diagram. A higher percentage of the people do it with an XY plot. In the case of an XY plot on a vector network analyzer where normally the horizontal axis is frequency and the vertical axis usually is displayed as decibels of S11 reflection coefficient if you're measuring input impedance matching, for instance. And sometimes people will display it as voltage standing wave ratio, but the usual display is S parameter, decibels of reflection coefficient vertical, and frequency horizontal. When you do that, assuming the vector network analyzer is well calibrated, let me drop. You're now about to run into a really peculiar characteristic of physics and decibels. Let's assume now that I was doing my normal business that I did for 10 solid years. For 10 solid years, I, as an antenna engineer, working for my favorite client, I was building extremely low standing wave ratio, 915 megahertz, Yagi-like antennas. Some of them were Yagi-like, but these antennas had to have something like 25 to 30 decibels of suppression of echo from the antenna. In other words, S11 is minus 25 or minus 30. That's something in the vicinity of 1.05 standing wave ratio maximum for the antenna performance across the frequency range of 902 to 928. So I was deep into the area that I think you're now discussing. And let me show you what happens here. Assume now that I'm displaying something that's a little bit more typical for people who recognize. If I was doing a swept antenna pattern in an anechoic chamber, let me drop. And every real antenna that's well-tuned, that has a little bit of gain to it, will have a main lobe and a side lobe to the left and to the right, at least one. Most antennas, anything more than complicated than a dipole, will have a side lobe. And between the main lobe and the first side lobe, there is a null. There's a place where, at a specific angle of reception from that antenna, the signal really goes to zero. And what does zero mean? If you're displaying it as voltage, zero is very easy to display. If you're displaying it in decibels, zero is a negative infinite number of decibels. Now, how close to real zero? I mean, you think it went to zero, maybe it went to one, maybe it went to 0.001, which would be something like minus 60 decibels if it's the voltage response. 0.001, I think, is minus 60 decibels. And so, depending on how big a scale you set vertically on that screen, you're going to see real violent action, so to speak, as far as how fast the display is moving in the vicinity of that null. So any kind of a low reception, near nulled signal displayed as decibels give you this peculiar performance where you called it another set of a pattern, so to speak, near the bottom of the screen is what I think you're saying. And so this is a mathematical function, law of physics, of nulls, of near zero signals. That's the one thing decibels have a lot of trouble handling, near zero voltage amplitude or near zero power amplitude signals displayed on decibels start approaching negative decibels that go to infinity, and therefore they become difficult to display. So that might be part of what you're asking, John. KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. Yes, I believe you are talking about the phenomenon that I am seeing. And just to make sure that we are talking about the same thing, even if we connect a load, you know, we will see this as well. So a precision load, a very high quality, like the one in the calibration kit, also shows this same pattern.
Absolutely. You've hit a good point. A good calibration procedure applied to a vector network analyzer on a good calibration test set will also display this characteristic. Now, this is something that requires training. When a person is staring at the screen and he'd be using a dummy load and he is now using a torque wrench where he's doing doing the precision number of inch ounces or newton meters or whatever of torque he's applying to an SMA connector that's being connected to the end of the cable. Hopefully it's a quality piece of cable, part of the vector network analyzer test set. It requires a very special cable that doesn't have any shift in characteristics as it's bent and deflected. So you're now using this precision wrench, and you're watching the screen as you tighten down that SMA or APC connector, and you will see the bottom of the screen dance around in a funny way. And at first, you'll think something wrong is going on. There's another time where you're going to run into this problem. Let me drop. Where you're testing an antenna, and you're measuring the reflection coefficient of an antenna. Let's assume that it's a three-element Yagi that's got 6 dB over isotropic gain of its forward lobe. And it's got a first side lobe to the left and to the right that is, we'll pick a number of 15 dB down, 17 dB down. So you're looking at the display and at the angles where the pattern goes near null, where the number of negative dBs becomes a great big number near the bottom of the screen. If anybody waves his hand in front of the antenna 10 feet away, because you're looking at a very precision null of something that's near zero, the slightest shift in perturbation of reflection of signals in the environment will make a huge difference in that display. You could be standing 10 feet away from an antenna while you're sweeping the antenna on a positioning motor platform. You've stopped the sweep. You're sweeping the antenna in azimuth, and let's assume that 30 degrees off to one side, 30 degrees away from both sides, you found the first null, and you stop the machine, and you just keep there and looking at it. So now you're analyzing the depth of the null between the main lobe and the first side lobe of this antenna, and while that null is present, the signal coming out of the main lobe of the antenna and the signal coming out of the side lobe of the antenna is also bouncing around in that chamber. Even though you call it an anechoic chamber, even though each one of those bounces is being suppressed by 40 dB because you've got good anechoic material on the walls. Let me drop. Still, you have a very precise nulling of signal in that direction. And somebody stands 10 feet away from the antenna and waves his hand a little bit, and you'll see that null jump up and down by 15 decibels. You'll say, what in the world is going on here? And that's because the precisionness of a null, the near zero characteristic of a decibel display, has this peculiar characteristic that a decibel cannot really display a true zero, because true zero is minus infinity in dB. So the decibels down there move real fast. Correspondingly, if you aim the antenna in such a way that in your anechoic chamber you're now measuring the boresight, main lobe, and you stand in front of the antenna and you wave your hand, the signal will change on that display by 0.1 dB or 0.01 dB.
So when there is from 2313,
when there is no null going on, when you're getting a strong signal, the exact same amount of echo off of your hand, when looking at the main lobe, it will give you 0.1 or 0.01 decibels of change in the amplitude of the display. And yet the exact same antenna, the exact same environment, the exact same hand, standing in front of the antenna 10 feet away, when you're near the null, you wave your hand, you'll see the signal change by 15 decibels, maybe 20 decibels. Because and by the way, the amount of voltage shift of the signal in either case could be the same. Maybe it's a few millivolts of signal shift. A few millivolts of signal shift near zero is a huge number of decibels. Near boresight, a few millivolts of signal that reflects off your hand, when the signal already is a volt of signal, it represents an extremely small number of dB. So the exact same amount of echo, whether you're looking at the strong portion of the display or the weak portion of the display, makes a huge difference. The first time that people are using a vector network analyzer, for instance, or a spectrum analyzer, let me drop it. The first time they see this phenomenon, they're positive that something is wrong. They're positive the antenna has got a broken connector inside, because how in the world can it move by 15 dB when I'm looking at a null, but it only moves by less than a tenth of a dB when I'm looking at a peak, when it's the exact same perturbation of the environment, the exact same guy standing out there in the anechoic chamber waving his hand. And you're talking about about basic physics of the way a decibel behaves near 0 volts. Maybe that makes some more sense, and it's a beautiful learning curve you're going through on this one, John. And by the way, properly used, a vector network analyzer when designing antennas, boy, can that machine do magic. I started off cutting my teeth on Hewlett-Packard vector network analyzers in roughly 1980, and I learned to hate that machine because they were so slow, so hard to use, so difficult to calibrate, and so on. I got reintroduced to a real good Rohde & Schwarz vector network analyzer, good to 8 gigahertz, in roughly the year 2002. And boy, I've learned to love that machine because I was using it every day of my life designing these crazy antennas for this unusual requirement. In the case of a radio frequency identification reader or interrogator, the antenna must have extremely low reflection coefficient because it's looking at the echo of a tag on the exact same frequency. And any echo due to standing wave ratio of your antenna that's on the front end of your interrogator will give you a signal that that clouds what you're looking for. It's the equivalent, let me drop. It's the equivalent of standing in front of your picture window at nighttime in your living room, and something is moving around outside in your front yard, and you want to use a flashbulb. So you turn on the flashbulb of your camera, and you think through the picture window you're going to take a picture of what's in your front yard. You rapidly recognize the fact that the reflection off the window of the flashbulb is going to be clouding the thing you're looking for. That exact same phenomena happens with a radio frequency identification circuit. You're looking at the radio echo of the tag, and any echo you're getting from your antenna that's looking at the tag is going to cloud the signal you're looking for. You're getting a flash back into your eye, if you know what I mean. Do you see the relationship there, John? KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. Very good, Dick. I really appreciate that explanation, and the extras are even more fascinating. Looking forward to exploring that even more. But do you mind if I expand the question one step further?
You're on a good question, on a good educational area. Go for it, John.
Okay, so now let's say we take the same network analyzer or similar equipment like the S parameter, and we now measure something like a filter or an antenna where our return loss is much higher, maybe around negative 15 or negative 25. And we do see in antennas and filters that we have these similar bumps, this similar pattern. Is that also the same phenomenon, or is this the actual measurement of that piece of hardware? Go ahead.
Keith Roy, what about this subject?
Okay, I'll get back to you in a minute, Joe. When you're tuning a filter, assuming the filter is made out of quality materials and the filter has relatively low true insertion loss, in other words, there are very few lossy elements inside that filter. Inside that filter, you have nearly pure inductors, nearly pure capacitors. And this, assume now I'm tuning a bandpass filter, Chebyshev or Buddyworth bandpass filter. And just to pick numbers out of the air, maybe the filter is supposed to pass 144 to 148 megahertz and reject everything else. And let's assume that it's a four-pole Chebyshev filter with a half dB ripple. Therefore, across the pass band of 144 to 148, I'm going to see four bumps in the pass band, half a dB of peak to valley of ripple, and then steep skirts on higher frequencies than 148, and a steep skirt going down to the bottom on lower frequencies than 144. That's my four-pole Chebyshev experimental half dB ripple filter I just described to you. And when it comes to tuning up the individual inductors and capacitors inside of that filter, assume I've got tuning controls on the outside of this filter, and I'm trying to peak it up for best performance across 144 to 148. Let me drop. With some difficulty, I could be setting the display so that I have 1 decibel per centimeter. I've got an expanded display, and I'm looking at the passband, and I'm tuning these inductors and capacitors and trying to tune what I think is the best possible passband. That's the direct approach the average guy starts off doing that. A smarter person realizes that he uses the inverse tuning characteristic, that a low-loss filter, properly tuned, across the passband will display extremely low standing wave ratio. So rather than looking at the passband of the filter, you look at the S11 reflection coefficient, the standing wave ratio, at the input port of the filter when the output port is terminated with a good broadband 50 ohm load. And now you tune for the deepest possible nulls in the S11 display, the standing wave ratio display, the voltage reflection coefficient display across the passband. You tune those, you tune the individual inductors and capacitors so that you get the deepest possible nulls of a particular characteristic, a particular pattern down at the bottom of the screen, so to speak, when you're using 10 dB per centimeter of display, maybe 5 dB per centimeter, but it's not an expanded display. You've got high dynamic range display, and you're doing the inverse tuning. And the reason why that works is because that filter, by definition, must obey conservation of energy. Let me drop. Inside it. Inside of that passband, that filter, by definition, takes all of the input power, pushes it through the filter, and sends it to the output load. Therefore, it dissipates nothing. It reflects nothing. So when you, in the passband, adjust for minimum reflection characteristic, automatically, with much higher resolution, you're adjusting the filter for the best insertion loss. You do the inverse tuning. You tune for the deepest possible nulls across the passband, and you get a much higher quality tuning characteristic in a much more shorter period of time when you do it that way. And by the way, in the skirt areas where the filter, it's hard to believe that a filter doesn't pass the reject frequencies, the frequencies below 144 and the frequencies above 148 in my example, your filter is not going to pass those. However, remember the words I used in the beginning. The filter is made out of high-quality inductors and capacitors. There is no internal resistors, so to speak, in this quality filter you and I are building, John. As such, it has no ability to take those reject frequencies and absorb them. All it can do is send them back to the source by way of reflection coefficient, by way of standing wave ratio. So when you're doing this inverse tuning, you will see nearly 0 dB of reflection coefficient, all the signals reflected, that's an infinite standing wave ratio, in the stop band areas. So you get this very characteristic curve of strong reflection in the stop bands and strong negative dBs of reflection signals in the pass band when you're doing the inverse tuning. A smart guy who really learns filter tuning, when he discovers that technique, will say, wow, this is so much faster, so much more precise, so much easier to use. Why the heck hasn't somebody told me about this earlier? KC2SHO, K2LIW.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You've got it, John.
And much appreciated, although there is one more part to this. And yes, unfortunately, I did learn that very early, and I was on an operation where we were changing television channels every week, so the tuning of the filters was something I became very good at. But now let's say it's just an antenna with some significant broadband response. Would the nulls or the lows in the return loss there is that pattern more a result of the antenna's properties than it is the product of physics, as we were speaking about earlier, as some antennas only measure around, you know, minus 11 or minus 15 or so dB of return loss. Good.
Yeah, in the case of antenna tuning, of a multi-element antenna, and people make the mistake of thinking that a multi-element antenna is like a multi-element filter. Absolutely not. If I'm tuning a 3, 4, 5 element Yagi antenna, am I tuning a 3, 4, or 5 element filter? Absolutely not. A Yagi is not a filter. It has a couple of characteristics like a filter, but it's not. If you're doing a good job of tuning an antenna that has some gain and a real pattern to it, like a Yagi, and the Yagi will give you the best possible pattern when the driven element gives you a good impedance match across your frequency region. It gives you good polarization characteristics. In other words, if it's a horizontally polarized Yagi, you want no vertical polarized energy coming off that driven element. You want the driven element to be fed with a good impedance matching balancing structure so that you're not launching any signals coming down the outside of the coax cable. So you're really feeding a pure signal to the driven element. Let me drop it. And once you've established that the driven element is doing what it's supposed to do, and now you're starting to tune the three directors on this, let's assume it's a five-element Yagi. You have three directors, a reflector, and a driven element. And now you want to tune the, each individual director to have the right length and the correct position so that you get the best forward gain across the frequency region of interest, which might be 144 to 148 megahertz, for instance. And now, as you tune those individual elements, two things happen simultaneously. Number one, each individual element, if it's a director, is by definition tuned a little bit shorter than the resonant length, so it is a variable capacitor in three-dimensional space. Therefore, each one of your directors constitute a tunable, variable, slow-wave structure. That string of directors out in front of your Yagi is a slow-wave structure, and believe it or not, is a synthesized equivalent of a magnifying glass. You're tuning those directors so that it acts like a magnifying glass, so it takes a great big chunk of area of radio signal out in front, and that area, by the way, is considerably larger than what you see when you look down the boom. The, in the case of a Yagi at 144 megacycles, each of your elements might be 1.5 feet long, and so you think that it's only gathering energy from a 1.5 foot diameter space. A well-tuned Yagi might be designed, might be gathering energy from a 7 foot diameter of space on that 2 meter example I'm giving you. And it's taking that 7 foot diameter of signal from space, focusing it down to the driven element when you've got each of the directors the right length and the right position so that they give you this particular slow wave structure that has a particular velocity profile. In other words, each individual director is not the same length. The spacing between them in general is not the same spacing.
Repeater, timeout.
The spacing between them is not the same spacing. The length is not necessarily the same length. But when you get it tuned just right, you get the maximum forward gain across the frequency range of interest, and you get simultaneously a good impedance match across the driven element. As you change the tuning of each one of those parasitic elements, it does have a perturbation effect on the impedance match of the driven element. So assuming you've got some variable controls on the way you feed the driven element, maybe it's a folded dipole-like structure where you've got sliding clips out of the tips. It's a key match, so to speak. And so you can change the length of the driven element and the way you impedance match to it as being fed with a good balance, and therefore you get the best combination of standing wave ratio and gain simultaneously. And in order to do that, with a good vector network analyzer, and that's what I was doing day in and day out for multiple years when building these Yagi antennas for a interrogator, for a RFID handheld reader, I had to use the vector network analyzer in an XY display where there had to be two separate curves on that screen. Let me drop. What I discovered is there are ways that I could tune the directors and driven element, so I got a beautiful standing wave ratio, but I got terrible gain. The signal was squirting off into some other direction. Correspondingly, I could get beautiful forward gain, beautiful pattern, but terrible standing wave ratio because the impedance match to the driven element wasn't compatible with the tuning of those directors. Therefore, when you're using a vector network analyzer, a modern VNA, to do Yagi optimization, and I did that day in and day out for quite a number of years, I would display a blue curve that was the gain, a yellow curve that was the reflection coefficient. I now am tuning each individual element with a tuning tool, literally. securely, which is a small piece of copper tape on the end of a long wooden rod, and I'm holding that copper tape near the tip of a 915 megahertz parasitic element, and as I hold that piece of copper tape near the tip, I'm adding capacitance to the tip. Therefore, that element becomes tuned lower in frequency. Or I can hold a piece of copper tape near the center of a driven element, of a parasitic element, where I'm doing some shunting of the magnetic field. That tunes it to a higher frequency. So with this tuning tool, I could go down the strength of each one of those elements while I'm watching the real-time display on the screen. And what I'm looking for is I want the blue curve to go up, I want the yellow curve to go down, and I want both to happen simultaneously. When you're using the vector network analyzer for giving you the best possible performance of display and the most amount of information per instant, let me drop it. You will put two simultaneous plots on that screen. They're both vertical decibel display plots. The blue curve is the decibels of forward gain. The yellow curve is the decibels of reflection coefficient. And you're doing the tuning, in my case, so that yellow goes down and blue goes up, and you make them happen simultaneously across the frequency range. When you're doing that, you're getting megabytes of data displayed on that screen simultaneously, flashing into your brain, and if you know what you're looking at, you're getting a tremendous amount of empirical analog information displayed 30 frames per second on that screen. There isn't even any flicker. You're looking at it happen in real time. As such, I could tune 10 individual antennas per day with that tuning procedure. 10 individual designs, different frequency regions or whatever, per day, because the procedure for picking up individual element lengths and positions and individual gains and standing wave ratios is all happening simultaneously on that screen. You have to recognize the fact, let me drop. And in the case of something like a five-element Yagi, for my particular example right now, that there is a conflict of interest between best possible impedance match of the driven element and best possible gain of the forward lobe of the antenna. The two are not mutually exclusive, but they conflict. So the fact that you've made the VISWR good doesn't mean you've maximized the gain. The fact that you've maximized the gain doesn't mean you've maximized the VISWR. They're two independent measurements. Don't let one contaminate the other. You have the ability to display simultaneously both on that screen. And if you use it that way, my goodness, you're getting 10 man days worth of work out of one human being that knows what he's doing when he's doing that tuning procedure. And he can, if you tried to do that with computer modeling, you wouldn't come close. To computer model each individual Yagi antenna with each individual one of the parasitic elements, with all their finite elements, and to enter all that data into the machine, let it grind away and come up with what you think is an answer, and then try to find out which way you should move in order to make it better. It would take you a month of Sundays to do it with computer modeling. In the real world of ham radio tinkering, as I'm going to call it, with a tuning tool and a properly displayed vector network analyzer, you get a tremendous amount of data in a hurry. You get a whole lot of real, hardcore, accurate information that does not require post-computer optimization. Let me drop. If I try to do that similar procedure by using the best programs I can get a hold of, NEC, mini-NEC, micro-NEC, high-frequency structure simulator, CST studio, microwave studio, any of those computer modeling programs, $30,000 programs, I tried to do it with those programs, I wouldn't come close to the same speed and accuracy of data. The example I'm giving you is one of the world's places where empirical, real-world, real-time testing with the right kind of test equipment in the ham radio philosophy is way ahead of computer modeling. All of the schools right now are teaching us that computer-aided engineering, computer-aided design, computer modeling, they're leading you to believe that it's the be-all and end-all. A high percentage of all the antenna manufacturers out there brag about the fact that we model it first, then we build it. Sounds good on paper. Follows the philosophy of the school. Dead wrong in many cases. You will never discover many of the antenna designs. You won't live long enough to discover the antenna designs that I have patented by the procedure I've just described to you, John. KC2SHO, you've got the test equipment, and when you use it in this manner, You're going to make some magic happen. Over to you and John, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Sorry for the delay. My node was IDing. Let me make sure I have it.
You sound beautiful.
Good, Dick. I love the explanations. I love the details you go into. You are igniting all kinds of synapses here in my brain. And I do have the equipment. I have some older equipment I purchased myself because as previous life offered me, I had this stuff in a lab and I had the resources of some companies to provide me with these. But more recently, I haven't had that, so I went out and started to purchase some equipment myself, an HP older network analyzer, an HP spectrum analyzer, power meter. Started to pick up all the passive components to help me get back to where I was in my learning before I was derailed from this this learning experience that these companies offered me. And I really appreciate guys like yourself who are willing to share this information with me, and some of the things you've explained tonight are things that when I've asked engineers in the past, like about the response of the return loss and that pattern at the bottom of the screen, they waved it off and said it wasn't important. But still, the question always burned, and sometimes we cannot find this online in our searches. Let me let it go for 1 second, and I'll continue. Okay. Did you get all that?
Got every word of it. And the one thing you're going to be running into now is that my experience with Hewlett-Packard earlier vector network analyzers is that in many cases you have to recalibrate them once every hour or two. They seem to drift. Many of the Hewlett-Packard earlier ones and even some of the later ones, I don't know why, but the Hewlett-Packard ones, the calibration would be lost within a couple of hours. That Rodin-Schwarz vector network analyzer, the one that goes to 8 gigs, that was purchased roughly the year 2000. I think it was a 1998 model or so. I don't know what in the world Elric Rode did in there. You can calibrate that thing on February. Turn it on and off every single day. In December, you go back and check the calibration, and the damn thing is still calibrated 60 dB down. I don't know what the hell he did to make that happen, but boy, he hit the magic key on that one. KC2SHO, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
Well, I'll keep that in mind. The experiences of others with their test equipment is very important indeed. And I guess I'll let it go for now. We got every Sunday to continue these types of things, and maybe I'll think of some deeper questions for next week. You've given me quite a bit and a lot to chew on, and you've already got me thinking about how I'm going to convert my basement into an anechoic chamber. But because I think the next step for me is to start with some antenna design. And a lot of experience with stuff that's manufactured, installing it, testing it, proofing it, tuning it, all that stuff that we do as technicians for the companies buying the equipment. Now I want to really learn the whys, and you're helping me do that, Dick. I really appreciate that. I'm going to do a shameless thing and say, Eric, if you do need help up there, I am an out-of-work television technician, so there you go. Hit me up on QRZ. All right, I'll let the TechNet go back to its normal mode here. Thank you, guys. We really appreciate it, and I hope I can have something to add as well in the near future. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Yeah, I'm going to give you another funny story, John. A major organization in Illinois had a very large antenna testing department in two separate towns with multiple anechoic chambers. And the head of the department at the antenna engineering laboratory visited the facility on Long Island where I was working at the time. And I'm building these, what I thought are very high performance, 915 megahertz, three element Yagi antennas to be used on a handheld RFID interrogator reader. And in that particular case, I'm tuning with a vector network analyzer, on a quote anechoic chamber. I'll give you some words on that in a minute. And I'm tuning these antennas for best forward gain of the main lobe, the boresight, best standing wave ratio of the driven element, and nothing else in the pattern did I